Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. My first guest today, pianist Linda Holzer, has always brought new ideas and/or works to the recital she presents at UALR, often with guests, friends, or colleagues from the UALR Music Faculty, where she is Professor of Music and Coordinator of Piano Studies. This by no means covers the whole range, which includes piano lessons and an interdisciplinary course with a professor from the College of Engineering and Info Technology. There are new works in her recital on February the 5th, but nothing of technology to challenge her audience. She opens the program, joined by baritone and faculty member Ferris Allen, in three songs, Prayers and Blessings, a new work by well-known composer Gwyneth Walker. And Linda continues her concept of ear opener in her program title, Ear Opener, A Celebration of the Known and the New.
Yes, well, I'm using it in a playful sense, and I hope that it entices the audience to come hear a program that is a mix of the known and the new. There are pieces by famous composers from the Western European tradition. Scarlatti and Mozart and Bach are represented on this program. But then there are also new pieces, fresh works from the 21st century by Gwyneth Walker and from the early 20th century by Little Rock native Florence Price. I like my audiences to have a sense ahead of time of anticipation, so hence the title.
So with that in mind, do you feel it reaches the audience when you use it in your mind rather than saying as such what you're trying to do?
Yes, exactly. I think the title speaks for itself. You may remember Gwyneth Walker from her previous visits to Arkansas, because I know you were doing Art Scene even then. She was commissioned by the Quapaw Quartet, and she was also commissioned at another time by the Arkansas Chamber Singers. She's very versatile, and she's written music for soloists, small ensembles, and large ensembles. And of course, Little Rock native Florence Price has received international acclaim as a pioneering African-American composer. And both of these American composers, I believe, have created very expressive, compelling works that deserve to be heard more often than they are. And I feel that the pieces by the famous composers that I've paired them with complement them. Florence Price's sonata is a big work, almost 30 minutes long, and it's in E minor. And I've paired it with the Bach Toccata in E minor. And I think expressively they have a lovely kinship.
What is the date of Florence Price's piece that you'll be playing?
Approximately 1932 is when she composed it, as A Century of Progress.
Brooklyn Rider, did you get to hear them when they were here?
I did not. I had another engagement that evening.
Because I did an interview with one of the two violinists, and he said the music is interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Up for something I had said, he was glad I used the word listening to the music versus hearing. Whether you're listening or just hearing what somebody is saying or playing.
Yes, and in fact, that's the subtitle of one of my lectures in the Donaghy Scholars course, Creative Arts 1, Listening versus Hearing. And hearing is more passive, and listening is active. And certainly at a concert, one hopes that the audience comes prepared to listen attentively.
Yes, but not everybody sort of associates the difference between listening and hearing. So the movement that you played on that Coterie concert of Florence Price, I was impressed by it. I hadn't heard the piece, so I'm looking forward to hearing the complete work, because it does have a considerable amount of, in that movement anyway, international style.
Oh, there's no question. Florence Price was very talented, and, you know, she wasn't your average good piano student as a child. And in fact, her level of skill propelled her forward, and she became a student at the New England Conservatory, and she did very well there. And one can imagine in Boston the concerts that she must have heard in the early 20th century and the composers that she was inspired by. Boston, of course, has a rich tradition of the Western European lions. And when I hear her music, I hear very convincing originality, but also the clear influences of having studied Beethoven and Brahms. And her piano figures are in keeping with those pianistic traditions. Big figures, runs, they're very virtuosic. Of course, she passed away before I was born, so I never had the opportunity to meet her. But I know from her writing that she likely had large, strong hands. Evidence suggests that she composed her piano sonata for performance by herself as well as others. To my knowledge, the work was not performed in Little Rock during her lifetime. With assistance from historians in Little Rock, we have attempted to research this, and we can find no evidence of public programs where the work would have been performed. And I had the pleasure of sharing it for the first time in March of 2013 as part of a Society for American Music National Conference that was held in Little Rock that year.
Was it a familiar work for you before you moved here?
Yes, it was. Florence Price was my dissertation topic as a doctoral student at Florida State University, and I had studied the work in manuscript form. And at the time I was working on my dissertation treatise, it was not available as a printed score. That happened when Raylinda Brown, a musicologist in California, published through Shermer an edition of the work. And that's really what has opened it up for more pianists to consider programming it.
You mentioned the fact that you felt she had big hands from her compositions. Is that something that you have in common? That's something that you have a large hand for a pianist, that when you meet somebody who's writing that fits nicely under your fingers, you assume
yes.
that you have something in common.
Yes. I don't usually have trouble with big reaches, but I can tell you from the figures that there's no question Florence Price's hands were probably larger than mine. So
that was nice. Then the other piece you mentioned, Gwyneth Walker, yes. I have, I think, interviewed her for...
Probably
a conference when she was going to be here, or somebody like Chamber Singers may have...
Yes.
You know, one of the earlier hosts of Chamber Singers might have done it. And I'm sorry, my memory doesn't click in immediately the way I would like it to, particularly these days.
Well, I would say that her piece, Prayers and Blessings, is very poignant. And I had wanted to perform it for some time. And I was delighted that Ferris Allen was interested in collaborating with me. As I built the program, however, the piece took on another meaning. During the past 7 months, it seems the news reports of tragedies have been compounded, from international crisis in Syria to the terrible events at Charleston's Mother Emanuel Church and in San Bernardino and in Chicago. And the message of this music, Prayers and Blessings, is peace. And this will be the opener of the program at UALR on February 5th, and I see it as an antidote for a turbulent world. I think it's helpful to remember that good music is timeless. Florence Price composed her sonata in 1932, but it speaks expressively to listeners today in the 21st century. Bach composed his toccata in 1707, some 309 years ago, but it's a very exciting piece, a masterful piano work full of life. You don't have to wear a powdered wig and Baroque buckled shoes to be moved by it. And I came across a delightful quote recently by Sir Isaiah Berlin, who, if I understand correctly, was a philosopher politician from Latvia a long time ago, and he observed, they say when the angels play for God, they play Bach. When they play for one another, they play Mozart. So I've included both on this program, and I don't know if I'll be the angel, but I'll do my best.
Composer Domenico Scarlatti. So where does that fit? Because that just comes after the songs of Gwyneth Walker.
It does. I think it's a lovely transition. Lyrical with lean textures.
Oh, then you got Mozart, yes. Mm-hmm. And then Bach.
Yes. The Mozart, yes.
After Mozart. So that would have been an interesting decision to make.
Yes, and it's not based on historical period. It's really based on the expressive content of the pieces.
So because of its style, because of its size, because of your feeling for it, that's why you've put Florence Price as the final piece.
Oh, yes. It's the most dramatic work on the program, and it needs to have the last word, so to speak.
Is there any in her writings clue as to when she was creating this sonata and if she had any thoughts about it?
Oh, gosh, off the top of my head, I don't recall that kind of detail. I know that between 1926, when she and her husband moved to Chicago, and 1932, when she completed this sonata, those were very productive years, and she composed quite a bit of concert music during that time.
What else did she write that added to her reputation while she was still alive?
Very lovely art songs. Oh. And she set some of the poets of the Harlem Renaissance. And you may recall that the soprano Rosephanie Dunn Powell used to perform works by art songs by both William Grant Still and Florence Price in concerts around Arkansas when she taught at Philander Smith in the late 90s.
I wish there was more on record to be able to play these over the air for a program.
Yes.
And
well, more is being done.
Mm-hmm. It does depend on ideas and support for.
Yes. No question.
Yeah.
But there are more recordings available now than there were at the end of the 20th century. So I'm very encouraged that she is getting her due, or closer to getting it. I had the opportunity to submit my concert recordings of her sonata to radio stations abroad. So my performance of her sonata in E minor has been heard on a classical radio program in South Africa and in Indonesia. And I was able to perform her work on a lecture recital at a conference in Melbourne, Australia, this summer, and I would like to imagine that that would make Florence Price smile.
That was pianist Linda Holzer, professor of music at UALR. Her recital, where she will be joined by baritone and colleague Ferris Allen, is on Friday, February the 5th at 7:30 p.m. in the Stella Ball-Smith Concert Hall on the UALR campus. The recital is free and open to the public. My next guest is folk singer from Tennessee, Caroline Doctorow. She has brought her trio here before, when she has also been my guest. Thanks to Len Holton, host of the Little Rock Folk Club and the radio program From Albion and Beyond, a program which is regarded, and I quote, as one of the best folk programs out there. Caroline's father, the very well-known author E.L. Doctorow, died recently. And she touches on his influence and support of her work and how his death has brought another dimension to her music.
The other point I wanted to make is that in terms of my music and my father, he was always very supportive of me, to put it mildly. I've kept a lot of phone messages. messages he left. One is about, he said he was watching Channel 13 and there was a special on about banjos, and he was always doing things like that. But the connection is that when I was a kid, my parents had a little sort of hobby folk music band, and we listened to all the great artists, you know, the Weavers and Tom Paxton and Bob Dylan. So it, using my professional life, you know, as a musician really helps me sort of keep that spirit of my father alive in my life. And the other thing is my father had such an amazing mind, and he had a wonderful political mind, and he could talk really on any topic about politics. Obviously, he was very much leaning towards the left and liberal. And I don't really have a political mind, but I've found since his death that at least in music I can express things, whether it's singing a song by Richard Farina. Birmingham Sunday, for instance, is one I recorded about the four little girls killed in the racist bombing in Birmingham, Alabama in the early 60s. These are ways that I can also connect with him.
Is this a tour that you're doing when you come to us here in February?
I'm touring, although I don't have a new record out yet. My most recent record is called Raven Girl, and that is a retrospective of my past, you know, 25 years in the music business. I have been at the Little Rock Folk Club really only one other time. We're happy to come again and play all kinds of great traditional folk music and more recent songs that I've written in that tradition. And I will have a wonderful fiddle player with me and an upright bass player. So I think it's going to be
That's your faithful trio, then.
Yes, exactly.
Now, I'm looking at the one that I got when you were here before. It was called Another Country, and Raven Girl is the second song on that disc.
Right, yeah. So that CD, Another Country, was the first ever retrospective of the work of Richard and Mimi Farina, who some of your listeners might know or iconic folk artists that recorded in 64 and 65. And Mimi Farina was Joan Baez's youngest sister. She's now deceased. She died in, I think it was 2002. And Richard Farina, her very well-known sort of cult figure husband, died quite young in 1969. But he managed to write an amazing amount of beautiful songs. I think the best known is called Pack Up Your Sorrows, which Johnny Cash and Judy Collins, Joan Baez, many, many people have recorded. But oddly, until I put out my record in 2009, nobody had done a full retrospective of their work. Now there is another one by a band called Plain Song, and I haven't heard it, but I heard it's really good. So the Farinas are finally getting their due.
And so much can be said in music with words, because sometimes the people who write the words to the music are reaching another dimension in terms of communication. And I was thinking of that while you were talking, and when you were talking earlier about your father's death, that it's that kind of not quite normal discussion, dimension, if you like, that brings out feelings. And
that's such a good point. And Bob Dylan himself has said, quote, "I try to write three-dimensional songs." And in the case of Richard Farina, if I'm remembering the lyric correctly, in Birmingham Sunday, his song about the horrible bombing, racist bombing in Alabama that killed four little girls, he mentions each of the four girls by name in the song, and apparently that was so important to him that their names be spoken. But he also has a line, and I think it's about one of the little girls, and he says her thoughts, something about her thoughts and her prayers would shame you and me. And what he was saying was this was a totally innocent person that was killed.
For this tour, will you be bringing some Richard Farina and his wife songs that haven't been heard recently?
Yes, we're definitely going to play them, especially given Len's his love of, you know, American folk from that era. So we will most certainly be playing that. We also play some fiddle tune, American fiddle tune instrumental type songs, which people seem to really love. I mean, who doesn't love the fiddle?
Yes, it's the same as a violin, and you don't hear them referred to as fiddles quite as often, but that's what it is, basically.
Right, that's true. A fiddle is just another way of saying violin. It has to do with the music that you're playing on the violin.
Now, talking about fiddles and violins makes me think of way back into the history of folk music when they wouldn't have known, some of them, that what they were making to play on would have been called something different somewhere else because
yeah.
it was a fiddle and they were fiddling.
Right. But I worry a little bit about all that being lost, mm-hmm. you know, because people are so buried in their cell phones. And
I know.
I hope that people continue to actually make things with their hands and sing to one another when, you know, that's another part of that song that I wrote, remembering my father and all the trips my parents took us on, is that we really had nothing to do in the car, so we would have to sing and talk to one another and tell funny jokes and
yes.
look out at the scenery, and it really gave the young mind a good foundation of being able to entertain yourself and to be alone in a way with your thoughts.
I had a long talk, interview with Johnny Cash's drummer, and we were talking about the early tours that he would make with the band, and it would be by train, and you'd see so much of the countryside. You'd get to know your country. Now you don't. You leave an airport, you land at an airport, and you don't look down because you're too far up. So much of children's travels that I can remember so well and loving so much, going by train.
That is very true. And I remember, you know, my mother is from Hickory, North Carolina, which is another place we're stopping this time around. And we used to visit my mother's parents, and we would take the sleeper car train from New York, and that was beyond exciting to
imagine. I love the sound of the rails when you're lying on it. It's all dark outside.
That's great.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned just not too long ago about lyrics that you write. Do you prefer other people's lyrics?
Well, it's certainly easier when you're making a record to not have to struggle, you know, writing songs, but at the same time, it seems to be an important, you know, thing to do. And I won't really say that it's easy for me to write my own songs. And sometimes you have to wait months before a seed of an idea becomes a song.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For instance, in the songwriting process, it seems to me that the point of view is really what writes the song in the end. And when I saw that phrase that I mentioned earlier in the gift shop, which is live like someone left the gate open, I couldn't really write a song just hanging on that one phrase. So I really, really had to think about it. And I happened to be reading an article one day that was written by a man, a writer, and he lives in New York City, but he also has a country home, and he was really upset with himself that he, every year in the spring, he would say that he was going to go out to the country and just sit in the hammock or sit on the beach and do those kinds of things that we don't seem to take enough time to do. And so that helped me with the second point of view of the song, of just really trying to live in the moment and you know, remember these times when you were a kid, when you were really were in the moment. But, you know, it took months for me to finish the song. And that's just my writing process.
It'll be very moving, I think, when it comes to the point where you can write lyrics like poems, write lines not necessarily matching of your father.
Yeah. You know, I don't know.
It'll come because it's part of your tribute to him, but it'll be a wee while, I think.
Yeah, and the other thing that I should say about this new record that I'm working on is that the songs that we do cover that are not my own are all songs that our family listened to on the stereo in the living room and growing up in New Rochelle, you know, by Donovan and Dylan and Leonard Cohen and Randy Newman, writers like that, that I just sort of feel like my music foundation was built upon those people. And my father and mother had a lot to do with that because, fortunately, we liked a lot of similar music, and the hi-fi, as you called them back then, was kind of always on. So in that way, it's also a tribute to my father in terms of the song selection of the cover material.
Did you have, growing up, an awareness of the history of American folk music and the countries, Scotland and Ireland particularly, where they come from, where they came from, the tragedies and the joys and what those far-off countries for a child growing up in America would not have known of?
I think I did dig around in that way a bit, especially because the person that I most admire, Joan Baez, sang so many beautiful English, Scottish, and Irish traditional ballads. You know, and a lot of those were about struggle. And, you know, so I did research that a bit, and I was, you know, certainly aware of it, if that answers your question.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. No, no. I think with parents such as you had, they themselves, or like my father, letting me browse through the encyclopedia wherever it had things with poetry and history, and that he would know would appeal to me to augment what he had taught me, that your parents would have been the same. If they saw you with a book, they would never interrupt you.
Right. Yeah, I mean, obviously our house was filled with books, still is.
And you don't realize when you're a child how wonderful it is to be left alone with a book. Nowadays, you can never get that way. There's always something that'll interfere.
Right. That's very true. We all don't read as much as we should, or I don't.
And your trio, the three of you, all have backgrounds with music from the very beginning, probably, but not necessarily all the same. So you not only bring your own backgrounds, but you bring your own style and approach to music.
Well, I would like to think so, yes. And the other piece of the puzzle is that both of my fellow musicians, Gary Oliar on fiddle and Carl Allwire on upright bass, you know, we sing in three-part harmony, and that, I'm hoping, brings it to a whole another level, because you sort of create another voice that is different than my own voice alone.
Caroline Doctorow, singer, songwriter from Tennessee, known throughout the South in her trio, in which she plays acoustic guitar and is the principal singer. Gary Oliar, fiddle, guitar, and duet harmony, and Carl Allwire, upright bass and harmony vocals. They're on a mini tour as of February the 3rd, coming to the Little Rock Folk Club Saturday, February the 6th, 7:30 p.m. in the Unitarian Universalist Church on Reservoir Road. For more information, call 663-0634. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.